Miami-Dade ends its curfew. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
Hospitalization rates are down, death rates are down. We are moving in the right direction. With the proper protections, we can open up a little bit more.
Miami-Dade is ending its curfew that's been in place since last year. Is it the right time? Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava explains. Also, there's a shift happening in Florida. Power is going from local governments to the state. Why the power grab while Republicans control state politics? And finally,
a Gentile dancing teacher wants to tango with you in the TV contest.
A rabbi learns the tango in one of the films highlighted at this year's Miami Jewish Film Festival. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Miami-Dade County is leading the state in COVID-19 vaccinations, with more than 800,000 people receiving doses thus far. Increased vaccines combined with a slowdown of COVID spread has led Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava to lift the midnight curfew on businesses across the county beginning Sunday at midnight. It's a welcome change in policy for restaurants and bars who've been forced to send home spring break crowds in the evening. But public health experts have warned that COVID-19 variants are spreading rapidly in the Sunshine State. Individuals cannot let their guards down. We spoke with Mayor Levine-Cava earlier this morning about the decision to lift the curfew and the county's plan to reach herd immunity through vaccination. The lifting of the curfew represents a key change in policy for your administration, as Miami-Dade remains the only county in the state with a curfew. Why is it time to change course now?
We have really tried hard to do everything in our power to allow normalcy, and the precautions that we've taken over the last year have worked. The curfew was an important part of the toolkit that we had, but we feel now, with the increased access to vaccination, with over 850,000 people having received at least a first dose, the fact that we have good precautions in place across our businesses, the fact that hospitalization rates are down, death rates are down, that we are moving in the right direction, and that with the proper protections, we can open up a little bit more.
You know, I mean, we know that COVID variants are still spreading throughout Florida, and young people are seeing the highest number of cases. Is there a concern that lifting the curfew, that maybe we might see another spike? Health officials say we're not out of the woods yet.
Correct. So, definitely, there is always a concern. However, we always have to balance that with the other considerations. So, for example, we've allowed adult senior centers to open, and childcare centers can increase their capacity based on the CDC guidelines. We've allowed now people to remove their masks outdoors when they're 10 feet away from others. We've looked at a variety of ways that, based on the science today, different than a year ago when these guidelines were created, ways that we can help people be safe, but also restore some level of normalcy in their lives. So that's what we're counting on. Young people are flocking to the vaccination sites. We're going to do everything in our power to make sure that people of all ages continue to have access. Yesterday, we spoke to Jared Moskowitz, the Director of Emergency Management for the state. He's helping us to deploy vaccines to more sites. We are aggressively making sure that people don't only avoid getting sick, but avoid spreading it. And that is, unfortunately for young people, often what happened. They might contract the disease and have fewer symptoms and then spread it to others. So with the advent of the vaccine, with the awareness of precautions, we believe that we can safely change the curfew.
If that threshold, the positivity rate, exceeds the threshold of 5% set by the county, is there an appetite to reimpose a curfew?
If we see a spike in cases and a spike in hospitalizations, we definitely will need to revisit the protections that we have in place. So, you know, the curfew was upheld by the courts. And by the way, Palm Beach also had a curfew. So it's often said that we were the only, but that's not true. And of course, all across the country, many places do have, and across the world. So curfew is a part. It's not the only. It's not the most important. The most important is masking, social distancing, and disinfection.
So what are the requirements for businesses to, you know, what do they need to follow in order to stay open past midnight? And how are you going to hold them accountable?
So the same guidelines are in place for businesses. If they can have the proper social distancing, if they enforce the masking, then they can continue to be open. So we have still the enforcement possibilities through police and through code enforcement. That's at the county as well as at the various municipal levels. And we trust that our businesses will do the right thing. We've had very, very good compliance. The business community has been very supportive, has taken all the measures requested during this pandemic. Overall, and we feel confident that they will continue to do so.
You know, we still have to practice social distancing. And I know you've seen the photos and videos. There are places here in throughout South Florida, bars and restaurants, the streets packed, a lot of people without their masks, and everybody close in together. So, how do you see these businesses being held accountable when you see that? How do you stop that from happening?
So for sure, when these instances are reported, they are checked out by law enforcement or code enforcement. That's the way it's been handled. And so it should not be a license for misbehavior. I think the word is out. People know that this virus is spread through the air, through particles, that close contact is dangerous. People continue to get sick, be hospitalized, and spread it to others. So we're going to continue with that messaging, and we're very grateful for the level of compliance that we've had.
What's the plan for Memorial Day weekend? Because you can expect large crowds. And we saw what happened in Miami Beach with the whole spring break chaos. But for Memorial Day weekend, what's the plan?
Yeah. So look, Memorial Day, Easter, New Year's, we have these times when people are so eager to get together and they let down their guard. We're going to work with the hotspots like Miami Beach to support them. We're going to be sure that we have our ambassadors out talking to the crowds, which is a wonderful volunteer effort by county employees to really help diffuse situations. And then hopefully there'll be positive activities for people to engage in safely. And that's what we'll be promoting. Celebration.
When you say supporting Miami Beach, what does that mean? Is it law enforcement?
Yeah. Up until this point, we have provided backup law enforcement. And if that is the request, we'll continue to provide that. Also, we're going to talk with the city about activities and what we can do collectively that will be positive alternatives so that people will feel welcomed when they come visit. Because after all, we are open. We are more open than most places in the country. We are enjoying the boom in our tourism economy, but we have to do it safely, and we need to make sure that when people visit, that we support them to do the right thing.
What have you heard from business owners about, you know, lifting this curfew and what that means to be able to stay open beyond midnight for them?
Well, they're very happy. We have had a lot of positives from the business community and from workers, many of whom made their living partly based on the after hours traffic. So definitely we know that this is a boom for our business community, for our economy. And again, look, we need to get all the people that are working in these establishments vaccinated. So we're putting out special messaging. We're doing special vaccination drives. We need to make sure that the people who are most at risk, which are the people that work in these establishments, are themselves protected as well.
I'm speaking with Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava. The county is lifting the midnight curfew beginning next week. Businesses will still be required to enforce social distance guidelines and ensure employees are wearing masks. We have more details on our social media at WLRN Sundial. One of the reasons you felt confident, you've mentioned here today, talking about lifting this curfew, has been the ongoing vaccination campaign. Dade is leading the state with more than 800,000 people already receiving their vaccines. How has the county improved the communication and the distribution, given, again, the stories of the lines and federal sites back in March and all those problems that we were having? What changed?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's the quantity. When we've got our first doses for public distribution on Christmas Eve with no notice. So imagine everybody scrambling to figure out how best to distribute. And since then, we've evolved. We have many, many points of distribution. Federal government has obviously decided that pharmacies are the most efficient route. Jackson has done just a yeoman's job of reaching out to local communities, giving, for example, churches pre-registration slots. We have now an outreach team at the county called Vax Now. It's vaccine accessibility for community safety, teams that go out with information and registration, helping people to get to these vaccination sites. We also have all kinds of ambulatory, mobile, pop-up sites. We've gone to the farm worker community. We have gone to law enforcement. We've gone, we're looking at college campuses. We're looking at the airport. You know, we're looking at many places where people can better utilize the vaccine when it comes to them so that we can rapidly deploy this vaccine. But the most important thing has been to make sure that it's equitably distributed. And initially, that was not the case. And so much has gone into making sure that trusted.
And I wondered, like, for you, here's what we remember seeing this last month, is a lot of problem with communication. And you have information coming from the state, information coming from the federal government, and then, of course, locally. And yes. I mean, we saw sites where they were giving out vaccines to anybody. This is back when it was still 55 and over, but yet people were showing up and they were like, oh, okay, yeah, well, we have vaccines. We'll give them to you, because people didn't know. Nobody knew. The communication wasn't there. Yeah. What did you, I mean, how challenging was that for you to try to, like, wrangle that from all these different groups?
When we started this effort, the first thing that I did was establish a shared information site, miamidade.gov/vaccine, also vacuna and vaccin in Spanish and Creole, to congregate all of the information about the different distribution points, the eligibility, because it was so hard for people to get information, and it was a full-time job. Even volunteer corps sprung up to help people get appointments. It was very hard. We did not utilize from the state the emergency management system that we had in place right here in Miami-Dade County. That was a great disadvantage for us. We have an excellent system that is utilized in natural disasters. We have been ready, and we have utilized that system. So we tried to make up for that discontinuity of information through the public awareness campaign at the county level. And then eventually the media caught up and figured out all the different sources of information and has really done a good job as well of spreading it. But it has been challenging, communication, and changing. It's been changing so often. We asked the governor to project eligibility ahead of time so people could prepare. And finally, that is what he did. He finally did signal with a week's notice that the age would be lowered. This is really critical, so people are not scrambling at the last minute.
And it's you have different government agencies on different levels communicating different things. The other thing, though, is this. It's about the availability of the vaccine, and that comes from the companies. Are you confident that the county can keep up the pace of vaccination, given issues that we've seen, like with distribution, like, for example, with Johnson & Johnson recently?
Yes. Well, that's obviously in somebody else's hands, but we've been assured by the president that everybody who wants vaccine will be able to get vaccine, and we are ramping up our efforts. Just yesterday in our conversations with Jared Moskowitz, we were told that we would be able to get additional vaccine. So we have the capacity to deliver over 100,000 shots a week. And that's what we need to do to really move forward. We haven't had that level of vaccine But we are ready. We have the mechanism to get that vaccine out as soon as it comes to us.
If there's an issue, I mean, there's a confidence in the president, but if there's an issue with supply, is the county ready to start prioritizing, you know, certain populations getting it like we saw at the very, very beginning of this?
Yeah, we are fortunately with the young people coming on board, not experiencing yet the need to focus on outreach exclusively, but we will be getting there. We will be getting to the point where we're going to be persuading people to come in. And by the way, vaccine hesitancy is down. As the vaccine has rolled out, as more people have gotten it and everybody is doing fine, we have a much smaller percentage of people who say they don't want the vaccine, but there are still people out there who are, you know, slowly coming in. So we are going to distribute all the vaccine we get, and there'll be some people who will wait till the very end. And, you know, we're confident that we will have the vaccine we need.
What do you mean persuading, by the way?
Well, first of all, there's people who are saying it's experimental. Well, yeah, I mean, it was rushed to market based on the government studies and protocols that it was safe. And we see that it's safe. So there's that. I mean, these are people who are just generally more skeptical or more cautious, but no need, because we see and they see that people of all walks of life, people from every background, are safely taking the shot, protecting themselves and their loved ones and the community. And so that's the good news that we're spreading.
In your conversations with health experts, what do they tell you, and what do you think about when you expect the county to reach herd immunity?
Well, I listened to Dr. Fauci, and then we all tried to see how we're doing. I think the good news is that the vaccine has proven to very much minimize the spread. So it's not just that it's protecting the individuals who are vaccinated, but actually reducing the contagion. That, I think, gives us great it was a key factor in the decisions that we made to loosen restrictions. So I can't give you a percentage, but I do believe that projections have been made by, you know, late summer or fall that we will be in better shape.
And you know, right now it's lifting the curfew. What do you expect, or what are the conversations about lifting the mask mandate? Because you start to see that in a lot of places in the country. And I wonder, is there pressure when you see it in other states and or even from Tallahassee? Is there pressure to say, okay, everybody else is, so maybe we should?
So every medical expert that I know advises that masking is the single most important protection that we can take for ourselves and for the community. So I am going to stick with that. And, you know, we are using the common sense. If you're outdoors and separated by 10 feet from others, you may be free. Obviously, CDC has now said that vaccinated people can be together gathering, not necessarily wearing masks. So in their homes, for example. So, you know, we're going to follow those CDC guidelines, but continue masking as a primary protection when in public.
That was Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava. You could read more about the county's lifting of the curfew and find all of our vaccine resources to get your appointment. Just go to WLRN.org. Well, still to come, want to open a barbershop or bakery in your home? A new bill could allow you to, drawing ire from local politicians. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Local governments in Florida normally have control over how business works in their communities, from who can do work in your home to whether your neighbor can open a nail salon in the house. Two new bills in Tallahassee would strip those powers from municipalities. They're part of a trend of bills this session that shift control from local governments to the state. WLRN reporter Danny Rivero's work is part of our series looking at how state leaders have wielded influence over Florida's local elected officials and voters. Stay tuned for more in the coming weeks as the legislative session continues in Tallahassee and beyond. Danny joins us now. Danny, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
You know, Danny, the focus of the series and your recent piece, this is how lawmakers in Tallahassee are usurping control from local governments. This includes like environmental regulations to cruising to how business is conducted. When did this start happening and how is it evolving under DeSantis?
So this idea has been around in the state of Florida for a while. It started many years ago with basically regulations of gun control, setting statewide standards for local governments. Say the city of Miami can't regulate guns in a different way than North Miami. And the idea behind that is that if you cross city lines, you know, you might pick up a charge in one place and not another place. And they wanted to even the playing field. So that's basically where it started. And in recent years, this kind of thing we can say has been accelerating. That now there's all kinds of things about, you know, limiting the ability of cities to regulate vacation rentals, to regulate. There's bills right now looking at limiting cities or counties from regulating polluters that they're concerned about, with concerns about the environment, about whether they can issue licenses for some construction businesses and all sorts of things. So it's it's escalating very quickly.
Yeah, all these things that usually go through local governments, now they're taking it. They want to have control over that. I mean, look, the Republican Party has had control of Tallahassee for a long time. Does the entire party believe in this sort of takeover, or are there people within the party that still champion what that party's always stood for, which is small government?
Right. I would be very hesitant to talk about this strictly in partisan terms. You know, there are a lot of Republicans, especially local elected Republicans, who feel strongly about this in the opposite way that the people in Tallahassee feel about it. So basically, Republicans at the state level do seem to be pretty much across the board on board with this kind of thing. And that is more of a reflection of them being at the state level and not being at the local level. At the local level, a lot of Republicans are very concerned about this, and they like local government. It's a pretty foundational conservative ideal, and they want to hold on to that.
Yeah, and again, as we mentioned, there are local politicians really upset about this. One of them, Miami-Dade County Commissioner Joe Martinez. Let's take a listen.
I just crawl into a bathtub in a fetal position and wait for the legislature to end and then come out and see the aftermath and what's the collateral damage that they have done.
How's Martinez wrestling with the stripping of local power from the session?
Right, so Commissioner Martinez, he is in a technically in a nonpartisan role, but he is Republican, and he's, you know, one of the people that is increasingly concerned at Tallahassee kind of taking some rights away from local governments and taking decision making away from local governments. And he's sponsored a couple resolutions at the county level aimed at these bills, just saying we do not condone this kind of behavior. A kind of a flip side, I think I would say of all this is that it's not all necessarily bad, right? Like it's not, you can't paint anything with a broad brush, because one of the things that Commissioner Martinez is upset about, for instance, is the state has basically taken over the Miami-Dade, the MDX authority,
right?
Which manages a lot of highways. Now he doesn't like that because it takes some control away from him, but a lot of residents are actually very happy about that, because that authority, even though it was locally run, they you know, heavily increased tolls. They were planning this road across the basically part of the Everglades that was, you know, environmentalists were very up in arms about. So the state has taken over that right now. He's upset about that, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily a good or bad thing. Some people like it and some people don't like it.
Let's take a look, for example. You looked at two bills in your recent piece focused on business. Normally, local governments give out licenses to contractors to do work on homes. How does that now change under the new proposal?
Right. So under this bill, State Senator Keith Perry, he's based out of Gainesville, introduced it. So yeah, say take Miami-Dade County, your construction business that you have, you want to change someone's roof in Miami-Dade County. You might have to take out local licenses to do that. There's state licensing and then there's local licensing. And that's because at the local level, cities and counties like to have oversight of that kind of thing. So what this would do was eliminate all local licensing for a variety of things, for like laying a new driveway, for doing cabinet work inside of a house, for like roofing. And it would make it so that the only licensing that's valid would be at the state level, which that upsets some people. You know, they want to have control over construction. They want to be able to ensure that the outcome of that kind of construction comes out like how they want it.
Again, I'm talking with WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. His story is about new proposals changing how business is conducted in the Sunshine State. It's part of the WLRN series, Tallahassee Takeover. Throughout this legislative session, we'll continue to shine a spotlight on legislation that takes power away from local governments and puts it in the hands of the state. Danny, the other bill, fascinating. It allows individuals to run businesses directly out of their homes, but what types of businesses? Can I do anything I want out of my home?
Well, short answer, basically, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, basically, yes. I mean, there was in a committee, there was a question asked of like, could I open a strip club in my house? Yes, you can. The answer was literally yes. And what this bill would do is that it would make it so that a municipality, a city, could only regulate businesses that are inside of a home in the same way that they do in a regular business district. So right now there's all these, you know, delineations between this is residential, this is commercial. You could basically do anything you want to do out of your home. They could regulate it to some degree, but they would regulate it to the same degree that they do as if you were on Main Street and you rented a commercial space there.
Yeah. And I mean, some of the other interesting things that came up, like if you ran a nail salon or hair salon or something like that, and a lot of people are parking outside your house, might upset the neighbors. You spoke with Senator Keith Perry. He's a Republican out of Gainesville who's sponsoring both measures. Here's what he said.
Young people aren't going out and making dynamic changes in our country, and especially in an economic way. And it's almost all due to legal and regulatory environment. So when I was a kid growing up, almost every business was owned by individuals. Almost every business. You drive down a main street of any town in the state of Florida, it's going to be owned. Today, almost every business is owned by a corporation or a franchise with exception. So it's shifted. In a 40-year period, we've had this huge loss of individuals being able to own and start a business.
How did Perry respond to the suggestion by local politicians that these bills are overreach?
Well, he kind of wrote it off. I mean, just to put it succinctly, he told me that you know, people saying that this is an infringement on local rights is a quote elementary or pedestrian point of view. And, you know, he said you should look at the particulars of the bill, which is interesting because the original bill that Senator Perry wrote, it wasn't just a free for all. There were some guardrails on it. It had some stipulations that, okay, if you open a business in your home, you can't dramatically increase the amount of traffic in a residential neighborhood. You can't dramatically increase the noise, which is some kind of guardrails, right? In the latest version, actually, those provisions are not even there. So whereas before there would be some guardrails of you can't have clients coming in and out all day long in a very residential street, very residential part of the city. Right now, the way it's written, you could have all that. You could have, you know, tons of garbage generated by your business. And there's nothing that a local city would be able to do about it.
So does that mean if it passes that local governments are just pretty much left high and dry? Or is it something where they basically will try to take it to court to settle there?
I mean, you would have to see. It's a good question. I mean, it's the kind of thing where we already know that local governments would be very upset with this if this passed. I mean, this is something, this proposed part of what local governments do.
Yeah.
Zoning is what local governments largely do. Some of the most heated disputes in any municipal government or county government, it's about zoning. Like, this is squarely what they do. So I don't know who would bring the case, but if this does come to pass and there's, you know, whatever kind of business you want to imagine opening next door to, you know, people who bought their home thinking it was a strictly residential area. I mean, I could easily see some litigation on something like this.
Yeah, this is so fascinating. It really is. Danny Rivero, again, check out his reporting on the Tallahassee Takeover. It's at WLRN.org. Danny, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
And by the way, we'd love to hear your thoughts on things like this. You could do it by joining our text club. We have a Sundial text club. You can post your thoughts, post questions. We'll get back to you because, you know, we would love to hear what you think about it. And you might even be part of the show, a future program. Joined by just typing the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's hello to 786-677-0767. Well, still to come, the Miami Jewish Film Festival about to launch. And even with the pandemic, there are a lot more movies than ever before. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Music can transport us. It gives us hope and healing. A new documentary concert film, Dreams of Hope, does just that. It tells the story of a historic concert at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, the scene of a horrible hate crime that happened back in 1963. The concert features musical instruments restored from Holocaust concentration camps. The film is featured in this year's Miami Jewish Film Festival that runs April 14th through the 29th. The festival is providing virtual and live events, including drive-in and outdoor screenings, all available for free. And you can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. We're going to look at two films. I want to start, though, with Henry Penyon III. He is the director and composer of Dreams of Hope. Henry, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. This is such a powerful movie, and the music, if you don't cry at some point, I don't know if you have a soul. Remind us of what happened, though, as we start. Let's set this this story up. It takes place in a very unique church. Remind us what happened there 50 years ago.
Well, in 1963, the four little girls, as we know them now, were killed when dynamite were set outside the church during Sunday school, and it went off. And that has become an infamous period in our history in 1963 at the 16th Street Baptist Church here in Birmingham.
Yeah. And you were very young when that happened.
Yeah, I was four. So when I saw it on television during the news, you know, it could have been in any other city. Just didn't have the mind to really think about it. And I think my parents may have been trying to shelter us from a lot of what was going on anyway, but it didn't resonate with me then for sure.
Yeah. So here's this concert that's being performed at this church, and it has these specific musical instruments, violins. They're called Violins of Hope. Tell me a little bit about these violins and how they ended up there.
The Violins of Hope are instruments that have been restored, recovered from the Holocaust. And a gentleman by the name of Amnon Weinstein in Tel Aviv has a long history where his father was instrumental in recovering some of these instruments. Sometimes they found them, sometimes families of those who were in the Holocaust, and even Holocaust survivors who had been able to save their instruments. Amnon basically started this passion of these instruments, and it grew. And when the Jewish community here in Birmingham thought about presenting these, it just seemed fitting that if they were to present them, knowing their history, that and knowing the history of Birmingham, particularly the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, that there might be an opportunity. And I don't think they planned it this way, but it surely turned out to be one where these two pivotal moments in our history came together.
You know, I mean, you're the composer, but also the director. How did you become part of this project?
Well, it started out first as a concert, and the concert was just going to be that and nothing more. The concert, display some of these instruments, have people in the community to come out. But when we had the opening concert, during the days before the concert, just seeing what looked like it was going to be such an amazing experience, we recognized that maybe we can capture this concert just to have for archival purposes. And as the concert began to happen, and then the night of the concert, it was just transformative. And people were just moved beyond belief, including those of us involved in it. So we were really just thrilled that we had captured it and thought that, well, maybe we'll have it. We could look at it maybe, you know, at the Jewish Center or some of the libraries or something like that. But then the thought arose that maybe we should try to do a little bit more. And I began to share my experience.
Yeah,
I began to share how I was so affected being an African-American male, knowing the history of course, what I thought was the Jewish history. I mean, of course, everybody knew about World War II, and we watched films, and, you know, I was big into anything that had war in it with, you know, just G.I. Joe, you name it. But then began to think about this in a way that I hadn't never thought about before, being transformed. And so wanted to make sure I had great respect for the culture and I represented the culture well, I began to study more. And about just the music, and I began to see all these similarities between the experience of the African Americans, particularly here in Alabama, and that same plight that the Jewish people experienced in the Holocaust. And so as that developed, we thought that, boy, it'd be nice to can tell my story, as it were, yeah, how I was affected being an African American male, you know. Go ahead.
No, I just got to tell you, I mean, watching this, you know the history of, or I mean, because you pointed out, you know, but just knowing the history of the church and then knowing the history of these instruments and that they're both together in this story is in of itself is just fascinating. And I'm watching you throughout the film and how you and the audience are reacting, knowing that link and how powerful it is between the Black and the Jewish communities.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. And that became the story.
Yeah.
I didn't really want a story about me. And then in many ways, those who are informed know about maybe the violins or separately know about the church. But when we think about the common plight of humanity, we think about the fact that, wait a minute, we are more alike and we share more experiences, be they good or bad, be they tragedy or triumphant ones, then we begin to kind of empathize with what other people experience.
Yeah.
And so a beautiful director was brought in and story writer by the name of David Macon, who was brought in to kind of really, you know, spearhead this story and make it cohesive in a way that, you know, was really about hope. I didn't want anything to be, you know, sad and morbid. I didn't want the music to do that, certainly. And I wanted people to be uplifted and have hope. Oh. And just that night to see Black, white, Jew, Christian, Hindu, Muslim,
yeah,
heathen,
yeah,
all there in church together.
It was, yeah, everybody. It does, and it worked. I think it worked absolutely beautifully. Again, we're talking about the 2021 Miami Jewish Film Festival, and we're talking with Dr. Henry Panion III. He's the director and composer of the film Dreams of Hope, and again, it tells the story of this historic concert at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Again, as we mentioned, a hate crime committed there back in 1963. Four young African-American girls were killed there. The concert features these instruments called Violins of Hope. These are violins restored from Holocaust concentration camps. Henry, hold tight for me a little bit here. I want to switch things over because we're talking about two different films in this festival this year. I want to bring in Gabriel Bologna. He is a director and produced the film Tango Shalom. Now we're going to switch things up, very different. This movie is about a Hasidic rabbi trying to realize his dream of dancing the tango, but here's a problem. Because of his Orthodox principles, he's not allowed to touch his dance partner, who's a woman. The Miami Jewish Film Festival, by the way, starts April 14th. It runs to the 29th, providing live and virtual events. Find out more on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Gabriel, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Tango Shalom. I was laughing so much during this and trying to figure out how you were going to get this man to dance with a woman and not touch her. I'm not giving it away. Clever how you did. There's a wide range of cultures throughout this story, trying to solve this problem. And again, you have this rabbi having this issue. And here's a scene from the film. He's trying to speak with a Sikh Muslim leader.
I am sorry. I cannot tell you to dance the tango. I would advise that you not even observe others doing the tango. You need to look into your own religious beliefs and come to your own conclusion.
You might find there is no need to touch this woman in tango.
But that's not possible.
Allahu Akbar.
Oh, so many scenes that...
yeah, I love you saying Allah Akbar, because he's just like, it's his way of saying oy vey, you know? we're so keen to think that we hear Allah Akbar and somebody has to, you know, pull a cord and there's an explosion. And that's just a very beautiful blossoming friendship that happens between this rabbi who wants to dance the tango and a friend that he makes along the way, played by Yasir Sitara, who's plays the imam. And oh, by the way, he's not Sikh. He's Muslim. I think you might have mentioned.
Okay. Thank you.
We do have a Sikh holy man that Rabbi Moshe Yehuda also gets advice from, as well as a priest. And they all share something in common with him in that they all have to navigate a complex modern world. At the same time, they have to decide how they can never sacrifice their beliefs.
Yeah.
To do so.
How did you want to approach this movie? I mean, you know, the subject matter.
Well, how fitting is it that here we have the Vatican, a Hasidic synagogue, a Sikh temple, a mosque. Like, really, we are the first film in history to be an interfaith movie. And it was... you know, of all things, a comedy. You know, who would have thought that maybe that's the one thing that all religions have in common? Laughter.
I kept thinking the whole time, it's just this idea, a rabbi wanting to learn how to tango, but he can't touch his partner. Why tango, by the way?
Well, you know, the script was written by the Laniato brothers, Jos and Claudio Laniato, who were both in the movie. They play brothers, real stretch. But, you know, this is really an autobiographical piece. You know, Jos Laniato, who plays Rabbi Moshe Yehuda, actually does teach in a Hasidic school. He also is obsessed with tango. he and his brother are refugees from Egypt due to the anti-Semitism that arose from the creation of Israel. They had to flee and ended up in, of all places, Argentina, where they would be hearing this incredible, you know, tango music that they would listen to. They're playing it in the streets. People are dancing in the streets. So, you know, Jos took it to a whole nother level. I mean, he became a fantastic tango dancer. He also teaches at an Orthodox school. He's observant Jew. And he got the idea because he was at a Purim party and he was seeing these just really badass break dancers who all happened to be rabbis and, you know, members of the Chabad congregation. Of course, they couldn't dance with women. Right. And he was saying to himself, you know what? How funny would that be if someone is like ultra orthodox, and they get the calling like he did to dance the tango.
Well, now I want to watch the breakdancing rabbis. But you know what? Let me ask you this. This is fast. I think my understanding is the film was mostly shot, or a lot of it was shot at 770 Eastern Parkway, New York. And for those who aren't familiar, tell us about that area and how did you get access?
Well, yes, this was the first film in history to ever shoot at 770. I mean, 770 is the pillar of the Lubavitch movement. We actually are in there seeing how they pray with the davening. And we actually used, you know, real Hasids. And, you know, there's been a lot of, I would say, very negative attention that's been brought to Hasids. Certain documentaries and certain films, they come across as very clannish. What people don't know is that the Hasids believe that the pious of all religions will be received in the kingdom of heaven. And they actually have quite inclusive beliefs, and they open their doors to us. And it was really extraordinary. And I can't just stop there. I mean, we shot in a Sikh temple, and wow, they literally demanded that they feed our entire cast and crew. And, you know, this is like a temple in Queens where, yeah, you know, everyone there is like immigrants from India that you know, don't even have shoes on.
I know.
As poor as perhaps my father's family from Southern Italy, or my mother's family from Belarus. And it was so funny. And they said to us, you know, we're the Jews of India, because we have been oppressed there. And I just couldn't believe how, you know, accommodating every one of these places of worships that we shot in.
I want to, only because of time, I want to bring in back Dr. Henry Panion III. And I want to ask both of you this. Gabrielle, let me start with you on this one. Both of your movies, music plays a very important part in the narrative in different ways. But I wonder, Gabrielle, with you, how do you see music as critical in understanding faith?
I can honestly say that every religion and every culture expresses their beliefs and their music in such unique ways that it's just incredible when you come across a culture like, say, Islam, right? Where, yes, dancing is in mainstream Islam, you know, it's looked down upon, right? And you know, sometimes even secular music is looked down upon. And yet we had the call to prayer sung in the mosque, in the mosque scenes. And it's very, very musical,
yeah,
you know. And, you know, the Jews are very, very musical people. I mean, the symbol of David is the harp, you know.
Yeah.
And we even got the Vatican Choir. I mean, we're the first film in history, the Vatican Choir, you know, in the film. And music plays such an important role in really civilization, both secular and religious.
And Henry, I wanted to ask you the same. Your movie does it differently, but yeah, how does music help us understand faith? And you're talking about faith from two different groups there.
Well, throughout history, music has played a role that perhaps words and speech never can. It can affect the domain of people's thoughts, their processes, their emotions, and their spirit. I mean, Gabriel just talked about David, but we all know that story too well, how David was brought in to soothe Saul by playing the harp. So I think that, and we look at the African-American experience, I mean, it was basically many times just through song that kept them. You look at the civil rights movement, and it was the civil rights songs. I mean, throughout history and throughout probably eternity, music will always and have always played an important role. I think there's a lot we know about the science of how music is constructed.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot we don't know about the effective domain of music and its power, its supernatural power to affect emotions and make change. I think that music brings people together. It is a universal language.
Yeah.
And having had the opportunity to conduct orchestra throughout the world. You know, we're talking about Forte, Bravo, all these kinds of things that we say. There's a universal language, and I can be in a different country. They understand those words. They understand
right,
that.
Right.
And it is so amazing.
I have to stop you there because of time. But yes, both of these films bring people together through music. Again, Henry Panyon III, he's the director and composer of the film titled Dreams of Hope. Gabriel Bologna, he directed and produced the film Tango Shalom. Both films are part of this year's Miami Jewish Film Festival. One thing I just want to mention, because of the pandemic, we can't go to a lot of these events, but the great thing is a lot of these movies are available to everyone streaming. You can find out more at WLRN Sundial, our social media. Henry, Gabriel, thank you so much. The beautiful films. I really, really enjoyed them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that is our program for this Thursday, April 8th. Coming up next week on Sundial, Governor Ron DeSantis has banned businesses from establishing so-called vaccine passports. We're going to talk about that. Also, a reminder that our Sundial Book Club this month, we are reading Miami by Joan Didion, the prolific author and reporter who spent many years here back in the 80s. Check it out on Facebook. Look up Sundial Book Club. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you next week.